Good morning. Please open your Bibles up to Psalm 34, where Brother Charles read a few moments ago, where we will get back to that in just a moment. I appreciate everyone that's here today. Glad to see so many back with us that were not feeling well recently. We have a lot to be thankful for, and I hope everyone's had an excellent weekend, hopefully a long weekend for most of you. Sometimes, you know, in our country, we do a really good job of, we got our little day of Thanksgiving, and then we rush right into Black Friday and Cyber Monday, and somehow it's Black Friday weekend and Cyber Monday week, and, you know, just full of greed and covetousness and all that nonsense. Let's just be careful not to get too caught up in that, but to remember who we are and what our purpose is in this life. There's a lot going on in our church family right now. Again, a lot that are back with us that have been out sick, some still at home recovering from things, a lot of taking care of family members that are ill and not doing well or recovering. So whether you've spent all weekend watching football or recovering yourself or taking care of someone that's recovering, whatever your situation is, I hope this lesson helps us all just kind of refocus from the busyness of the season, the busyness of life. Our lesson this morning is simply called Magnify. And we take that from Psalm 34, verse 3. It says, "Oh, magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name together." I want to think about that word for just a minute, magnify. When's the last time you saw a child with a magnifying glass? Johnny, for a long time, every time he went to my grandma's, knew right where the magnifying glass was beside her table. You remember that? And you'd want to go and take that magnifying glass and look at whatever you could find and try to, you know, see how it looked up close and make it bigger when he looked at it. And so eventually she got him a pocket microscope, and he would take that outside and try to look at trees and little things called tardigrades or some type of little, like, gummy bear-looking microscopic creatures. It's a real thing. You can look it up. And he tried to find these on trees and leaves and in a moss grown on trees, you know, whatever you can find. Any teacher will tell you, you get a box of magnifying glasses out, I don't care how old the students are, they're going to magnify everything they can get their hands on, from their pencil to their own hand, their neighbor's, you know, hand, whatever is nearby, they're going to look at it through that magnifying glass because it's fascinating. But sometimes as we grow up, we lose our fascination with things, with life, and we're not as interested in that anymore. How do you magnify the Lord? When you think about what that word means, how is it possible even to magnify the Lord? To magnify means you make something appear larger than what it is. You make something appear larger. How do you make God appear any larger than he already is? That's kind of a daunting task when you stop and think about it. God is already bigger than our wildest imaginations. Our problem is we try to minimize God. We try to reduce God. We try to reduce how much we think God knows. We try to reduce how much we think God cares about things. We try to limit, you know, what he can do in our minds, thinking he's not capable of taking care of whatever. We try to stuff God into our church building. And we think about, you know, a few basic things we were taught as a child, and so we limit him to those few basic things. We try to define God and limit him to our definitions. We read a description like God is love, and we'll even take that biblical description of God and we'll apply our own definition of love and constrict him to what we think love means. We do that all the time, don't we? But on the other hand, we're pretty good at magnifying some things in our life. We're good at magnifying ourselves. We live in a culture that encourages self-magnification, don't we? We're really good at magnifying our problems. That's where stress and worry comes from, is when we look at our problems in life and we magnify them. We make them appear larger than what they really are, and we get all worried about it and stressed out. We look for ways to magnify our pleasure and entertainment. So we get how to magnify things, but we struggle with magnifying the right things. We need to be magnifying God. So how do you do that? In simple terms, we magnify him by giving him our attention. When you're looking at that microscope, that magnifying glass, what are you doing? You're focusing in on just what you see through that lens, and you're ignoring everything else around you. So magnifying God starts with ignoring a lot of the chaos around us and focusing in on him. You magnify God by enlarging the role he plays in your life, in your heart. You promote him as Lord over your life, over everything else in your life. You give him a bigger place in your heart. In fact, you give him your whole heart, right? You honor him with every thought of your heart. So I want us to consider how to more effectively magnify God for the next several minutes. A God who is more than worthy of being magnified. Something that is magnified is said to be magnificent, right? There's the same root word between magnify and magnificent. Don't you want to see more clearly the magnificence of God? He's a pretty magnificent God, isn't he? I don't believe we will be able to fully magnify God, that we're going to be able to see his full magnificence while on this earth. But I think we can all do a better job. I know I can. So let's go to Psalm 34. Let's read. We'll start back at verse 1. And we're going to go through verse 7 to start. I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul shall make its boast in the Lord. The humble shall hear of it and be glad. Oh, magnify the Lord with me. Let us exalt his name together. I sought the Lord, and he heard me, and delivered me from all my fears. They looked to him and were radiant, and their faces were not ashamed. This poor man cried out, and the Lord heard him, and saved him out of all his troubles. The angel of the Lord encamps all around those who fear him, and delivers them. We'll stop right there. First, we just need to understand that we need to magnify God always, always, at all times in our life. It's interesting to consider when David wrote this song, because the text actually tells us. We don't get that with a lot of the Psalms, but the text tells us when David wrote this. And the story is found back over in 1 Samuel chapter 21. David is not the king yet when he writes this psalm. In fact, he's on the run from the current king, Saul, who's out to kill David, to murder David. Back in 1 Samuel 21, verses 10 through 15, it says, then David arose and fled that day from before Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. And the servants of Achish said to him, is this not David, the king of the land? Did they not sing of him to one another in dances, saying, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s? Now David took these words to heart and was very much afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. So he changed his behavior before them, pretended madness in their hands, scratched on the doors of the gate and let his saliva fall down on his beard. Then Achish said to his servants, look, you see the man is insane. Why have you brought him to me? Have I need of madmen that you have brought this fellow to play the madman in my presence? Shall the fellow come into my house? And so David had already developed this reputation as this mighty warrior. He was the king in waiting, right? They recognized him. They identified him as the king. He was the future king of Israel. And so he had this great reputation as a warrior. And so when folks in Gath find out he's there, they're worried. They go to warn the king that trouble could be brewing. And so to avoid trouble, David pretends to be insane. And the plan, for David's credit, seems to work, right? The king is not concerned with David being there. But for our point this morning, look at David's behavior. Think about David's situation here. On the run from the king who wants to murder him, and here he is in this foreign land, pretending to be insane, looking crazy. Read verse 13 again. He changed his behavior before them, pretended madness in their hands, scratched on the doors of the gate, and let his saliva fall down on his beard. But nevertheless, even at this time, David says, I will bless the Lord at all times. Saliva falling out, scratch. This madman on the run, that's the setting in which he writes Psalm 34. I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth, he says. My beloved, the point for us is there should not be a circumstance in your life that prevents you, that stops you and I from magnifying God. If you go back to Psalm 34, if you look over at verse 19, verse 19 says, many are the afflictions of the righteous. David offers no illusion here. He's open about the troubles that face a righteous man. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, he says. David understands this as well as any of us could. As well as any of us could. He was living through affliction while writing this. Still offering praise to God. But the last part of verse 19 says, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. David also understands the temporary nature of affliction. All affliction we face in this life is temporary. It's all temporary. We just have to remember that the Lord delivers the righteous. And so David would go on in Psalm 34 to testify of God's deliverance in his life. God's delivered him before, and he trusts that God will deliver him again. So that's what 4 through 7 is. It's David's testimony that he knows. He's seen God's deliverance, and you can count on it. Let's read it again. Verse 4, I sought the Lord, and he heard me and delivered me from all my fears. They looked to him and were radiant. Their faces were not ashamed. This poor man, he's talking about himself. Right? This man with the saliva running down his beard. This man cried out, and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all his troubles. The angel of the Lord encamps all around those who fear him and delivers them. Yes, we face affliction and we face trouble, but the righteous are never disappointed by God. Never disappointed by God. Here, David is assuring the audience that God will deliver them. I love that part in verse 6. This poor man cried out, and the Lord heard him. The Lord hears the helpless. He hears the hearts of the humble when they appeal to him. Even at our lowest, most pathetic and pitiful situations, God hears. And while he does not promise the absence of trouble, he does promise deliverance from that trouble. So no matter what afflictions you face, no matter how long they last, no matter how bad they are, your aim should always be to magnify God, even during times of affliction. What David helps us to see is when you magnify God in your life, when you magnify God, all of those other problems seem to be minimized. It reduces the afflictions in your life, the size and the scope of the problems in your life when you magnify God. Look at verse 3 again. Oh, magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name together. We need to magnify God together. Verse 3 says, David is inviting his audience to join him. He could have kept it to himself. He could have just magnified God and praised him and you know, done his own thing. But no, David wants others to join him. There is something special about worshiping God together that's worth our consideration. It's a humbling thing to be at a loss for words as a professional preacher, a guy that's supposed to talk for a living, right? But I find myself at a loss of words more often than I'd like. And when it comes to God's magnificence, kind of at a loss for words for that. I struggle to find the right things to say. When it comes to worshiping and magnifying God together, as we're doing this morning, as we've been doing since about 9 o'clock or so, and we'll continue to do for a little while today. The value of this, knowing there are others who love God, knowing there are others who go through the craziness of this world and have my interest, my best interest at heart, knowing the value of this fellowship we are a part of, I'm at a loss for words to explain the value of this collective worship. There's just something special about this time. Not these buildings, not these walls, not the seats we're sitting in, but there's something special about this time when we all gather together in unity, in love, in fellowship to worship God in spirit and in truth. Society has made it easier and easier to live lives of isolation. You don't have to leave your home for almost anything anymore, right? You can attend school online. I mean, you can K-12 online. You can attend elementary school online. You can attend college online. You can work from home online. You can shop. You can have groceries delivered. Who plans to do their holiday shopping online? If I don't have to go in a store, that's fine with me, right? That's great. There's a lot of good to this. But one of the sad side effects is some people think that you can worship from home just as effectively as gathered together. Now, maybe we gather in somebody's home. I don't care where we are. But, beloved, there is a difference. There is a difference between worshiping at home, watching Zoom, versus coming here and actually worshiping and engaging together. Those two are not equal. I'm grateful for the technology we have, right? Don't get me wrong. I'm very grateful that we can live stream services today. Right? I'm grateful for those that are logged in that aren't able to be here, right? That are sick or whatever. And so that you're able to come and join us in that way. I'm grateful for that. But watching worship on Zoom is still not the same. And I think we've all experienced enough of that to know deep. I don't think I have to convince you of that, right? It's just not the same when you're sitting at home by yourself or with your family as when you're gathered with everyone else here. There's no equivalent to assembling together. We might not always admit it, but most of us all, I think every human craves connection. I think we all crave connection. I think God built that inside of us. We crave meaningful relationships. You might not need to be the life of the party or to have, 100 friends or whatever, but you crave that relationship with at least a small group of folks. The problem is we don't often want to put the effort that is required to create those relationships. Because relationships require some things of us. They require time, for one. And we're all, stressed out on our schedules. We're all pressed for time. But it also requires vulnerability. Because if all you ever do is say, yeah, I'm good, and how are you, and, did you watch the game yesterday? Those things are great, but it doesn't really build much of a connection, right? If so, a pretty shallow one, to say the least. So relationships require some vulnerability. We want the connection, but we don't really want to put ourselves out there and risk the awkward situations that we're going to find ourselves in at time to build those relationships. I think one of the reasons social media is so big is because we want that connection, but we don't want to put in the work. And so we've created these pseudo communities, these fake relationships and fake connections with people. Right, because we all know social media is fake, right? 99% of it is just not real most of the time. And so we struggle with going about finding these. It's why gangs exist. It's why, sexual promiscuity is so big. It's why bars are so popular. We want to connect, but we don't know how to connect without, drinking alcohol so we can loosen up or whatever they say. I am convinced, beloved, that magnifying God together, what we're doing here, worshiping Him together, this helps build a level of connection with other people. This helps forge relationships that you're not going to forge any other way. You're just not. collective worship is not the only part of forging these relationships. It's not all there is to it. If all you do is come and worship together and then that's it, you're not going to have that relationship. But this is a crucial part. This is a vital part of forging the type of relationships that God has intended for his people. And not just sitting back and watching worship, but engaging in worship. The sad thing is, Satan has distorted the idea of worship so much that for so many places, most people view worship as something just to go and watch. And so if I'm just going to go to a building to watch worship, what's the difference in watching from a building and watching from my home? There is no difference. If that's all worship is to you, is watching, you might as well stay home, right? But worship is about engaging together. It's not about just watching. It's obviously a part of it, but there's more to it than that. I just think we need to be very, very careful about how we use Zoom, right? Zoom is not an excuse to skip coming together. It's not an excuse to sleep in late. It's not an excuse to add more things to our Sunday schedule because, well, I'll just watch on Zoom. That way I can go do this thing at noon and not be late for it. That's not what Zoom is for. If you're using it that way, you need to rethink it. I'm not the judge on how to properly use Zoom, but I think we need to just be cautious and careful that we don't abuse the technology we have. Use it for what it's intended for, but there's no substitute for coming together to worship and magnify God. Worship and unity go hand in hand. Yes, we worship God because we're unified, but I think at the same time, we're also unified because we worship God. It's cyclical. They both feed into each other. So we have to develop this unity by working and worshiping together. And let's just not take for granted what a blessing this is, right? This is a blessing to do this. There are places across this world where you are in serious physical danger if you attempt to do what we are doing right now. And we have no real fear of that in this country. Let's not take that for granted. And so with the rest of the psalm, of Psalm 34, David goes on from there to both persuade people to magnify God together and I think even instruct us how to magnify God with our life. Let's read the rest of Psalm 34 and then we'll take a closer look at some of that. Verse 8, O taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who trusts in him. O fear the Lord, you his saints. There is no want to those who fear him. The young lions lack and suffer hunger, but those who seek the Lord shall not lack any good thing. Come, you children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. Who is the man who desires life and loves many days that he may see good? Keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. Depart from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. The eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their cry. The face of the Lord is against those who do evil, to cut off the remembrance of them from the earth. The righteous cry out, and the Lord hears, and delivers them out of all their troubles. The Lord is near those who have a broken heart, and saves such as have a contrite spirit. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. He guards his bones. Not one of them is broken. Evil shall slay the wicked, and those who hate the righteous shall be condemned. The Lord redeems the soul of his servants, and none of those who trust in him shall be condemned. If you want to truly magnify God in your life, you magnify him with righteousness. If you want to enlarge his presence, to see him more clearly. If you want to see God more clearly, you have to try living righteously. Go back to verse 8 for just a moment. Taste and see the Lord is good. We've all sat down for dinner, and we've all heard a child, probably our own if you're a parent, say, I don't like that. Right? What's the first question out of any parent's mouth? Have you tried it? And a lot of the times is no, but I know I don't like it. You know what I'm talking about. We've all been there, right? We've all been there. Too often, people treat righteousness the same way. They treat godly living. They treat being a Christian this way. Right? They look at the Bible. They have their own preconceptions about what the church looks like and what God, who God is, not based on his word, but based on their experience out there. And they say, I don't like that. Have you tried it? Until you actually try righteous living, really try it, you can't honestly say you don't like it. Right? So David teaches us how to live righteously, and it starts with trust. Verse 8, blessed is the man who trusts in him. Trust means take refuge. It means you take refuge. And this tells us the attitude in which you taste and see, the attitude in which you try God and his righteousness is going to make a big difference on the conclusion that you come to. Right? If you, we've seen it with the kid, when they have their nose turned up before they even bring the fork to their mouth, what are they going to say when they try it? Ew, I don't like that, right? It doesn't matter what it tastes like. They've already decided they don't like it because they have the wrong attitude. They go into it expecting not to like it. A similar thing happens to God. Some folks' hearts are so hard, they've already determined they are not going to believe the Lord is good. Even with Christians who maybe have been a part of the church or, you know, grown up in the pews for a long time, when we have our own idea about what righteousness looks like and we come across some scripture that maybe challenges our thinking, even Christians can have their hearts so hard that they already turn their nose up before they even try it. And when we do that, you're not going to be able to have a change of heart. We call that repentance, right? Without having an attitude of trusting God, of trusting, okay, I don't like how that sounds. I'm not excited about doing whatever this verse says to do, but because I trust in him, I'm going to try it. I'm going to taste and see because I trust God. So I'm going to try it his way, but really try it. Righteous living also requires fear, verse 9. And we see this idea of fear several times. Verse 9 says, fear the Lord, you his saints. There is no want to those who fear him. Fear sounds like an odd component of a close relationship, right? I don't really fear Chelsea, right? I had to think about that. I don't. But we don't think about fear as being a healthy component of a relationship. God is different than anybody else in your life. Go back to Psalm 33 for just a minute. Psalm 33 offers a really interesting comparison when you read this and you go into Psalm 34. Look at verses 6 through 9 of Psalm 33. And think about who God is from this. By the word of the Lord, Psalm 33 verse 6. By the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, and all the host of them by the breath of his mouth. He gathers the waters of the sea together as a heap. He lays up the deep in storehouses. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him. Why? For he spoke, and it was done. He commanded, and it stood fast. We could read more, but I think this helps give us a reminder, a glimpse about who God is that spoke the universe into existence, right? Creation obeys his command, his word. God is amazing. He is magnificent. He's magnificent, so he's worthy to be magnified. I've never been to the Grand Canyon before, but I understand there's a lot of places without guardrails, right? And I've seen a lot of pictures. I hope to go one day. I've tried to imagine standing at the top. Maybe you've experienced this. Standing at the top, at the side of the Grand Canyon, just to, you know, maybe not right on the edge, but within a few feet where you can see down and recognize that's a long way down. And you see the magnificence of that scene, right? The splendor of that scene. And while that's an amazing sight, I can imagine there's an element of fear involved in that moment as well. Of this isn't the time to goof around. Because serious consequences could happen if I goof around and if I slip. It reminds me of the description of Aslan in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Chronicles of Narnia book. When Susan asks Mr. Beaver if Aslan, the lion, is safe, Mr. Beaver responds, "Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe, but he's good. He's the king, I tell you. Is God safe? Of course he isn't safe, but he's good. He's magnificent." And so there is a healthy fear of the God who created the universe at his word. There needs to be a healthy fear when we stand on the edge and approach him. And so righteous living also requires you watch your mouth. I thought of try to find a better way to say that, but this is what I came out. You got to watch your mouth. Go down to verse 13. "Keep your tongue from all evil and your lips from speaking deceit." It's easy to understand. We recognize complaining. We recognize dishonesty and foul language and crude jokes when we hear it. James warns about the use of our tongue. In James 3 and verse 10, he says, "Out of the same mouth proceed blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be so. Does a spring send forth fresh water and bitter from the same opening?" Doesn't happen, does it? Because if it did, the bitter would contaminate the fresh and you're left with all bitter. You can't do both. Psalm 34, verse 1, "I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be" where? "In my mouth." How are you going to praise the Lord with your mouth at all times if you are speaking evil, speaking deceit, using your mouth for these things that our mouth ought not to be used for as a child of God? James is telling us in James 3, if your mouth is filled with bitterness, dishonesty, and crudeness, and whatever, then God cannot be magnified from you. No matter what words you may say, God is not being magnified if you don't watch your mouth at all times. You cannot get fresh water from a bitter spring. So magnifying God requires we watch our mouth. We'll go a little quicker through the last few here. Verse 14, "Depart from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it." And this isn't talking about world peace, right? World peace is not going to happen, is it? It's just not. This is talking about your peace with God. You being at peace with God. That's what you need to be seeking. And you do that at its most basic level by seeking good. Seeking good and avoiding evil. That's the start. The righteous also cry out. Verse 15 again. "The eyes of the Lord are on the righteous and his ears are open to their cry." His ears are open to the cry of the righteous. Verse 17, "The righteous cry out and the Lord hears." You cannot live righteously, beloved, and ignore God. You can't do it. You can't ignore God. Remember, many are the afflictions of the righteous, verse 19. You're going to face affliction in your life. And when you do, the purpose of affliction, one of the purposes, is to teach you that you need God, to teach you to go to God. If you don't cry out to him for help when you face affliction, then you are not righteous because you're trying to overcome it on yourself. You're trying to be your own deliverer. And God needs to be your deliverer. The righteous cry out. Additionally, the righteousness involves simply serving God. Verse 22, "The Lord redeems the soul of his servants." What do you got to do to be a servant? You got to serve, right? You got to serve. You got to serve God with your heart, your words, your actions. All that's included within being a servant. Finally, yes, David is teaching us how to be righteous, how to magnify God in our life and to others as well through our righteousness. But he also gives us plenty of reasons. He persuades us by telling us some of the blessings of righteousness. Just four before we close out the lesson for today. 9 through 10, if you go back to verses 9 through 10 of Psalm 34, O fear the Lord, you his saints, there is no want to those who fear him. The young lions lack and suffer hunger, but those who seek the Lord shall not lack any good thing. The righteous get to enjoy God's providence. Again, doesn't mean your life is void of trouble. It just means regardless of your afflictions, even because of your afflictions as a righteous person, God provides you what you need to endure and eventually overcome. Philippians 4:19 tells us God shall supply all your need according to his riches and glory by Christ Jesus. One of the blessings of righteous, godly living is God's providence. Verse 15 through 16. You go back to that again. The eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their cry. The face of the Lord is against those who do evil, to cut off the remembrance of them from the earth. So we see God giving his attention to the righteous, right? He hears the righteous. He sees the righteous. But he's cut off from the evil. It should bring you great comfort to know that no matter what you are going through, God knows. God knows exactly what you are going through. You can't hide your pain from him. You can hide it from a lot of people. But God can look past that smile you put on before you came in the door, right? And that you show it as we shake hands and all that. God looks beyond that smile and he knows what's going on. He hears your prayers. The righteous cry out to God, right? He wants a relationship with you. He wants you to be comfortable in going to him. You're not a bother to him. He wants that from you. He wants to deliver you from your affliction. He may want you to learn a thing or two first, but he wants to deliver you. He's just waiting for you to call out to him. And that brings us to the next blessing of God's deliverance. 17 through 19 again, the righteous cry out, the Lord hears and delivers them out of all their troubles. The Lord is near to those who have a broken heart and saves such as have a contrite spirit. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. The word deliver means to take away. He's taking away our afflictions. He's sparing us of them. He doesn't always tell us how. Doesn't always tell us when. That's why righteousness requires trust. We got to trust him, right? Trust his process and his timing. But I believe at least four times the idea of deliverance is spoken about here in Psalm 34. In case you miss it once, you've got three other times to pick it up. God wants to deliver the righteous. And finally, verse 20 through 22, he guards all his bones, not one of them is broken. Evil shall slay the wicked, and those who hate the righteous shall be condemned. The Lord redeemed the soul of his servants, and none of those who trust in him shall be condemned. Not only does God remove the affliction, deliver us from the affliction, but then he fills that void with his redemption. Not something we deserve, not something we earn, right? The way verse 22 reads, his servants are already serving him. Our service does not earn us redemption, but God sees those who are serving him, and he comes in and offers and gives redemption. And in the end, no matter how much affliction you've endured, in the end, when you come face to face with God and you see his magnificence, your redemption will be far more than worth it. I think when you see the magnificence of God in heaven, if you were to have any regrets, and I don't think you will, but if you were to have any regrets, I think the only regret will be that we did not do more to magnify him in the time we've been given here on earth. But until then, we get to experience God's blessings in this life. And when you see his blessings, it should only make you want to glorify and magnify him more. Isn't that the exact effect God's blessings had on King David? Isn't that what he said back in verse 3? Oh, magnify the Lord with me. Let us exalt his name together. That's the effect of seeing God's blessings. When you magnify God in your life, God's magnificence is intoxicating. It's thrilling, and you want to share that with others and let them experience that as well. Oh, magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name together. Is God magnified in your life? If you want to live righteously, if you want to receive the blessings of righteousness, it starts with giving your life to God. Jesus said in Mark 16:16, he who believes and is baptized will be saved. And that's just the beginning. That begins a new life with him, walking with him, experiencing the blessings of righteousness. If you've not surrendered your life to God yet, we invite you to do that today. If you already are a Christian but need help with your faith in any way, we invite you to let us know so we can help you with that as well. Whatever the case is, if we can help you this morning, please let us know as we stand.